On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
El Nino, back and with a vengeance. In fact, one of the strongest ever.
This year looks just like 1997's insanely terrible El Nino.
Godzilla El Nino.
Godzilla El Nino.
El Nino Godzilla.
The building El Nino phenomenon, among the strongest on record, will change weather from coast to coast.
All other tropical storms must bow before El Nino.
Well, it'll be 75 and sunny today. LA had the warmest February on record. So what happened to that Godzilla El Nino? We'll talk about that later in the show. But first, if the weather hasn't been crazy enough for you, the election seems to be making up for it. It's Super Tuesday. Around a dozen states will vote in presidential primaries and caucuses across the country. And on the Republican side, it's expected Donald Trump will be the big winner. It's something few people saw coming just a few months ago. Here in the U.S., pundits and party leaders were caught off guard by the popularity of Bernie Sanders and have been bewildered by Trump's rise. But what about our neighbor to the south? How has Trump's harsh rhetoric on immigration played in Mexico? And what do Mexicans think of the Democratic side? From Mexico, we're joined by Carlos Puch, who works for the newspaper chain Milenio. Welcome, Carlos.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm great. So let me play a clip from Trump from the most recent debate and get your reaction to it.
We have a tremendous deficit. We have a trade deficit with Mexico. They'll pay for the wall. They'll be very happy about it. Believe me, I'll talk to them. They'll be very, very thrilled. They're going to be thrilled to be paying for the wall.
So will Mexicans be thrilled to pay for the wall if Trump becomes the president? You're laughing.
No, I don't think we'll be very happy about paying for that wall. I don't think we will pay for it. I don't see how he's going to do it. But it's a little absurd, everything that is happening. And I think it has caught not only the Republican establishment and the pundits in the U.S., I think it has caught the Mexican government off guard. And I think what started as a joke for us Mexicans 3 or 4 or 5 months ago, listening to this kind of rhetoric, now it's become much more serious, much more serious. I think the first reaction, serious reaction of the Mexican government, we saw it last week when Foreign Minister Claudia Ruiz Massieu talked to the Washington Post and called Donald Trump a racist.
But we haven't heard anything from Enrique Peña Nieto yet.
No,
he has been pretty silent.
Not a thing.
Why?
We haven't heard anything. I don't think they have a plan. I think they were caught off guard. I think somebody told them that this was not going to happen, that this was kind of a joke. And what we see is they don't have a plan. And let me put you a very good example. Leon Krause, who actually lives in L.A., a Mexican journalist that works for Univision there, wrote a piece in The New Yorker, I think, a couple of days ago. And he relates how he asked for a reaction about Trump to the spokesman of the president. And he got a very ambiguous, we need to work together. Mexico and the U.S. are very good friends. And then 4 hours later, he finds out that Claudia Ruiz Massieu calls racist. The foreign minister calls Trump racist. So I think what that shows is that the Mexican government right now doesn't know how to react on what has become a real threat. And when I say a threat, I mean a threat to the economic relationship between the two countries, the migration relationship between the two countries. And I really think right now they don't know what to do. I think they're going to wait and see what happens tonight. If everything goes as the pundits and the polls say, I think somebody in the Mexican government has to actually make a plan. And how are we going to deal with a candidate with some possibility of becoming the president of the United States?
So we have former presidents weighing in. Felipe Calderon likened him to Hitler. Vicente Fox called him crazy. And then he also said, I'm not going to pay for that expletive wall. And so they don't seem to be holding back. Are they channeling regular Mexicans' views?
I think they're trying to pressure the Mexican government to do something. I think because before those reactions, what we had seen from people close to Vicente Fox or Felipe Calderon was, columns and editorials and comments in the Mexican paper saying, why isn't the Mexican government saying anything? So I think what they are trying to do is send a message to Enrique Peña Nieto, you have to do something. And I think they are more worried about the economic part of what Trump would bring to the relationship to what regular Mexicans think about it. Because I don't think it has permeated in the Mexican general public opinion how bad a Trump presidency would be. I think we're still in the meme phase. I mean, we joke about Trump and the Twitter and Facebook are full of insults and jokes about him. But I think now it's much more serious. And I would think that the general public opinion in Mexico hasn't really realized how bad it would be for our economy.
All right. So let's talk about that. He's calling for a 35% import tariff on goods. He's calling to renegotiate NAFTA. Is that primarily what you're talking about?
Yeah. What I'm talking about is things that he has said, that he has written about in his website. The idea of renegotiating NAFTA, which he sees as a very, very bad agreement for the U.S., would be disastrous. I mean, the Mexican economy pretty much lives in because of that agreement, because of the amount of exports and imports we get from the U.S. The latest figures may be 80% of our trade has to do with NAFTA. Half of our foreign investment comes from the U.S., and he has said, I think it was in a debate, that he said that any company that tries to move jobs away from the U.S. and bring them to Mexico would face him. I mean, he doesn't give it specifics, but he says, and I would go to those guys, and I would talk to them, and you'll see they will not move jobs to Mexico, and they will not invest in Mexico. He has actually talked about confiscating part of the $20 billion Mexican-Americans, and not only undocumented, but Mexican-Americans sent to Mexico. He has actually threatened to not allow that money to get to Mexico. I mean, so those are the kinds of things that I think should really worry the Mexican governor. I think they're starting to worry. Mm.
Well, this is assuming that he will be the nominee and assuming that he would win in a general election against the Democratic nominee. So those are two big assumptions.
They are very big. I mean, I was just reading this morning a CNN poll that says that he's not competitive in a general election, but stranger things have happened.
All right. On the Democratic side, what do Mexicans think of Hillary Clinton, whose husband, of course, negotiated NAFTA, and Bernie Sanders?
I think Mexicans loved Bill Clinton. And I think the latest poll, like a month ago, the Mexican poll company did about if you would vote in the American election, who would you vote for? Of course, against Trump, Hillary was a huge success, and I think she's living on the very good image that Bill Clinton has in Mexico. I think Barack Obama is very well liked in Mexico, more because of his character than maybe things that he has done for Mexico or the Mexicans. So I think right now the Mexicans would clearly would love to have Hillary as a president. And then Bernie Sanders, it's interesting because Bernie Sanders has made a lot of news in Mexico because I would say that columnists, editorialists, intellectuals are looking at Sanders like a new economic model, like a new politician looking differently. But it's very much just in the upper levels of the intellectuality in Mexico where Bernie Sanders has made inroads. I think Mexicans would vote, if they could vote in your election, for Hillary by a lot of points.
Bernie Sanders voted against NAFTA. Do Mexicans hold that against him?
No, I don't think they even remember how Bernie Sanders voted at that time.
No, right, really, probably most Americans don't remember.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they make that connection. And again, I think Hillary's good image in Mexico has a lot to do with Bill. Bill was very, very popular here in his years as president, and I think Hillary lives of that. And then Hillary has these kinds of, gestures about Mexico, about migration, about good relations. He was a very, I think, generous foreign, state secretary when he was there with Mexico. So I don't think Bernie Sanders plays in the minds of Mexicans right now. I think in Mexico, this is Hillary against Trump, and in Mexico, Hillary wins by far.
Carlos Puch, a journalist with Milenio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, are you from a foreign country, but you live here in Los Angeles? What do you think of the presidential election? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will hear the most significant challenge to abortion rights in a generation. The case is about a Texas law that curtails women's access to abortion clinics. The law requires clinic doctors to have hospital admitting privileges and the clinics themselves to be certified as ambulatory surgical centers. And these provisions are so expensive and bureaucratically burdensome that at least 30 abortion clinics in Texas have had to close so far. Texas is not the only state that has enacted laws that are, in effect, abortion restrictions. Esme DePrez has been reporting on laws across the country for Bloomberg Business, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, first, tell us more about the Supreme Court case. It's called Whole Women's Health v. Hellerstedt. And what is the question before the court?
So, right, as you said, this case marks the first time the High Court will rule on abortion rights in almost a decade. And what the justices are weighing is this: whether Texas violated the Constitution with this law that passed under Governor Rick Perry in 2013 that providers have found it very hard to comply with. It's really hard to overstate how detrimental this law has been to access. Were it allowed to take full effect, all but one clinic would be in the state's four biggest metropolitan areas, and none would be in the western half of the state. The nearest clinic to El Paso would be 550 miles away. So that gives you an idea of the scale that we're working with. Women would really be left with very few clinics in an enormous state.
So you said all but one clinic would be concentrated in the metropolitan areas. And so that means for women in rural areas, what would they do?
Exactly. They would have to drive hundreds of miles away to obtain an abortion if they could. That would obviously be assuming that they could take off work. They have the money, to travel. They have the financial resources to be able to do that, which is often very difficult.
Right. So the Texas law that's being challenged is just one example of these types of laws that are popping up in states across the country. What did you find?
So since 2011, Republicans on the state level have really began this unprecedented push to regulate the industry out of business, often in the name of women's health, which is what we're seeing in Texas as well. So since 2011, that's when that push began. I have counted that 162 clinics have closed or stopped offering abortion. Just 21 have opened anew. So that really gives you a sense of, it's much easier to close a clinic and a lot harder to actually open a new one. That is the fastest annual pace on record, and the drop-off in providers has happened in 35 states, both small towns and big cities that are home to more than 30 million women of reproductive age.
So in the last 5 years, 162 clinics have had to close down. And are those other laws similar to the Texas law?
Correct. So state regulations like Texas's that make it too expensive or logistically impossible for facilities to remain in business, they drove more than a quarter of the closings. You're also seeing industry consolidation, changing demographics, declining demand for abortion overall. The abortion rate is going down. You also have doctors retiring and states cracking down on unfit providers.
So declining demand for abortion, what's behind that?
American women have started having fewer abortions before clinic closings accelerated in the last couple of years anyway, so that's really, you know, reduced demand in some parts of the country more, so less providers are needed. Some of the factors that medical researchers will point to is, take for the example, the recession that was accompanied by a decline in pregnancies. You're also having more women and more using contraception and more effective contraceptives as well, so that's really pushing down the abortion rate.
Okay, but also, is it also this lack of access to these laws that you say have forced 162 clinics to close? Does that have anything to do with the drop in abortions?
Certainly, we did see that in Texas. There was a study that came out in July that saw that the abortion rate fell in Texas. It's just really hard for medical researchers to pinpoint exact cause and effect, but undoubtedly, the reduced access obviously is going to mean that women have fewer places to go to terminate their pregnancies, and so, you know, in certain parts of the country, they're not going to be as likely to do that, and you're going to see the abortion rate change as a result.
Now, you did some research in California. What did you find?
California was really interesting. It's a state, you know, that's led by Democrats. They tend to be friendly to abortion rights. So we really don't have the same thing that's happening in Texas with, you know, lawmakers passing restrictive laws. California lost a dozen providers, two opened anew in our time window. And I will note that's probably a conservative estimate. I could only pinpoint 12 closings. I do think that there were probably more. I just couldn't confirm them. But it is hard to determine the cause of closures for all of these. But I got the sense from my reporting that there's a number of things going on here. First is healthcare industry consolidation. Sometimes it's simply inefficient to have a lot of smaller providers as opposed to fewer but perhaps larger ones. The second thing you have going on is price and competition. The price of an abortion has not practically changed in decades, and that's largely because providers often see their decision to offer this service as a social good. They think by definition it should be available to everyone regardless of their financial status, so that makes it really hard to boost prices while remaining competitive. And then three, you have those falling abortion rates that we're talking about that reduce demand for the procedure. And then in California, I mean, I just don't think there's the pressure to stay open. If you're a provider in California having a hard go of it, as opposed to, say, if you were in Mississippi, which only has one clinic, you know, the entire pro-abortion rights community isn't depending on you to stay open because there is, you know, pretty good access in California as far as abortion is concerned. You know, compared to, again, Mississippi, there's one clinic there. So the entire pro-abortion rights community is depending on that clinic to stay open no matter what it takes, not just because what it would mean for access in the state, but from a symbolic perspective as well.
There is just one clinic in all of Mississippi that performs abortions?
Yes, there's a handful of states where that's the case. And that's what, you know, abortion rights advocates are really worried about happening. They're really worried about seeing that happen in many states and, you know, states that touch each other. And so if you had a large swath of the country where, you know, there's little or no access at all, really what this boils down to is that fundamental constitutional right that a woman currently has to obtain an abortion ceases to practically, you know, be effective. It's not really useful to a woman if she can't find a provider to actually give her an abortion.
So I understand it was not easy to collect these statistics. They're not exactly publicly available.
Not at all. Over the past 3 months, I actually used as my main resource this list from a group called Operation Rescue. This is a Kansas-based anti-abortion group that gained notice in the 1990s after leading demonstrations that led to hundreds of arrests. So Operation Rescue keeps an online count of providers. What I did was I combed through that list of hundreds of closures that they said happened, confirmed through phone calls to area providers, to the shuttered providers themselves, and using even building documents to verify that first, these clinics had ever provided abortion, because that's a crucial fact, and then second, to confirm that they either closed their doors or they ceased to provide the abortion. So I did that work over the past 3 months involving, you know, hundreds of phone calls. But I think it just really gets at the scale of what we're seeing and how the reproductive health landscape is really shifting across the country.
So I can see why doctors, you know, when they're going into the profession or they've been in the profession for a while, would say, you know, unless there's a compelling reason to do this, i.e. I'm in Mississippi or another state like that, why would I want to risk this hassle to provide abortions?
Right, exactly. Even in a state like California, I don't think there's anywhere, you know, in the country where it's easy to be an abortion provider or it's non-confrontational to be an abortion provider. So it's really this sector of medicine that's kind of, you know, in a lot of ways walled off from mainstream medicine, and it really requires this, you know, commitment to face, you know, the whole anti-abortion community when you're deciding to practice as an abortion provider. And, you know, frankly, a lot of doctors just don't want to do that.
Esmé Duprez, national politics and policy reporter for Bloomberg Business. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'd love to hear from you. Have you or has someone you know ever had trouble finding an abortion clinic nearby that is affordable? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW PressPlay. Coming up, sports reporter Erin Andrews' ordeal at the hands of a stalker and her bosses at ESPN. That story is next on Press Play.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Fox sports reporter Erin Andrews has been testifying in court for the last 2 days. She's suing the Marriott Vanderbilt in Nashville and its corporate owners and her stalker, Michael David Barrett, for $75 million. Barrett stalked Andrews through a number of cities as she traveled doing her job covering college football. In three of the cities, he managed to get rooms next to hers at her hotel. And in two of those, he doctored a peephole between their rooms and took nude photos and videos with his phone. He then posted one of those videos online. News stories at the time suggested Andrews might have posted the video herself as a publicity stunt. So in order to dispel those rumors, ESPN, her employer at the time, insisted that she do an on-air interview about the video before she was allowed back to work. Here are two moments from her testimony yesterday.
Probably for like 3 months, everybody thought it was a publicity stunt. The front page of the New York Post and ESPN scandal. The Fox News and CBS, everybody put up that I was doing it for publicity and attention, and that ripped me apart.
Because there wasn't an arrest, because we didn't know where this happened, my bosses at ESPN told me, before you go back on air for college football, we need you to give a sit-down interview.
She gave that sit-down interview to Oprah. Mary Elizabeth Williams is a staff writer for Salon, and she's here now. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. So this video of Erin Andrews, it suddenly shows up online, and then people think that she actually staged it. Why did they think that?
Because why not think that anything that happens to a woman is her doing and her fault? Of course, especially if it's an attractive woman, a beautiful woman who is a rising star in the media. Why think that this would be something that someone had done to her against her will? That's the default. That's the place that I think our culture goes first. And, you know, this morning I was looking at the story and went back and looked at some of the reporting on this story 7 years ago and how differently the tone has changed now that someone has actually gone to jail for this mm-hmm. and someone admitted to stalking. I mean, the initial coverage was just, oh, it's a hot blonde who looks like it might be her. And it was, you know, it was incredibly prurient and leering and super gross.
Yeah. So Barrett, he spent 27 months in prison. And now I guess he drives a food delivery truck. He lives with his dad. I don't think he's paying anyone $75 million. The hotel says it's not responsible. So is this an uphill battle, do you think, for her?
Well, you know, one of the things that I read that I think is very interesting and I think may work very well in her favor is the argument that what is out there now this is a bell that can never be unrung, mm-hmm. ever. A computer expert came in and said that, 17 million people have looked at this video approximately, and that basically one person is looking at it every second right now. So,
and this happened in 2009, right?
This happened in 2009. Yeah, the video was leaked 7 years ago. So how do you, what do you do to a woman whose life is still being affected by that? What do you do for a woman who says that, who said yesterday in court that every day of her life, someone on social media makes a comment about it, sends her, tweets her an image from that video? How do you rectify something like that?
Yeah, so you can't get it taken down from these sites or taken down from people's servers.
Right. It's a whack-a-mole kind of a situation. It will never go away. So, you know, and the harassment that she endures and the, you know, the nasty commentary that she has to put up with will not go away. So what do you do? How do you make it, if not right, at least say to a woman, this is what happened to you was not okay? And how do you say to the next woman that this happened to, that this is not, that what happened was not okay? And how do you say to the guy who is thinking about tampering with a peephole in a hotel that there are consequences?
And what do you say to ESPN, which made her do this interview?
Yeah, well, let's just be clear. ESPN has not commented on that. Mm-hmm. ESPN has refused to acknowledge what really happened. But yeah, you know, how do you say to employers, your default mode cannot be that the woman has done something as a stunt, that the woman has done something that she is guilty of? There was a case I was literally just reading about less than a half hour ago of a high school teacher in South Carolina, who was told to step down from her job because a student stole her phone, found nude pictures on them, and distributed them. And here's what I want to get this right, because here's what the superintendent of the county said: students had access to inappropriate pictures of their teachers. That was his response. Students who stole a woman's phone told her to step down from her job and said that the students had access to inappropriate photos of her, of her private property.
So how do you think taking the Erin Andrews case and what was reported back in 2009 and how she wasn't believed and it was thought to be a publicity stunt, you know, do you think that the conversation and the attitude has changed in the last 7 years? I mean, do you think that would happen, would be the default response now?
I got to say, after reading that story about this teacher who just lost her job, no. You know, the idea that Erin Andrews says that she is still feels ashamed, that she still is upset and ashamed of what? Of walking around, of leaving the shower, of getting out of a shower in her hotel room, in the privacy of her hotel room. And how is that still being perpetuated? Sadly, no, I don't think anything has changed. I don't. I see every day on many mainstream sites, you know, a nip slip or a wardrobe malfunction or something that is meant to shame or embarrass women for walking around in what they believe is comfort and privacy.
Mm. Part of it, though, do you think, does it have to do with the fact that she was working in a male-dominated field as a sports reporter?
I think that definitely doesn't help, but you know, I think that there's constant commentary about women in the field, in sports and in sports reporting, and how good they are and how qualified they are. But I also think you see this everywhere, and I also think you would be hard pressed to find a field that we would not say is male dominated. What's not male dominated? Science, technology, politics. What do we have left? What do we have left that we
nursing,
can do as a profession?
Teaching,
yeah, that is safe, that is
hotel
safe
maids.
For women, right? And like I said, there was a teacher who lost her job today. So there's a male, you know, there's an allegedly female-dominated profession where a woman just lost her job because her phone got stolen.
You write a lot about women's issues, and we know that a lot of this harassment happens online. What kind of response do you get when you write about stories like this?
I get harassed. I get threatened. I have had, you know, horrible, disgusting things said to me. I have had disgusting images tweeted at me. You know, I would not in any way put my experience anywhere near the kind of experience that Erin Andrews has had or other women who write particularly about certain very hot topic issues get. But you know, I see it in my own life, and I always say, you know, unfortunately, I begrudge no woman the right to say, you know what, I don't want to talk about these issues. I don't want to talk about my own experiences because the price is so high. It takes an incredible amount of intestinal fortitude to be a woman with any kind of public profile, with any kind of opinion or image. You can be a regular woman who posts a picture of herself in a bathing suit, and you put yourself out there for scrutiny, commentary, threats, harassment. That's just, unfortunately, the world we live in. And, you know, I think all of us are trying to make it better, but it's an uphill battle, and I don't see progress. I don't.
Mary Elizabeth Williams, staff writer for Salon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, a new oral history of five families who shaped Los Angeles at a time when L.A. was ripe for the shaping.
The 20th century in L.A., there was just so much up for grabs. There was so much money.
West of Eden explores the behind the gilded doors lives of the Doheny's, the Warners, the Selznick's, and others. That story next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The history of Los Angeles is a history of the families who shaped it. Oral historian and author Jean Stein tells the stories of five families who shaped our city in her new book, West of Eden, including her own family, the Steins. Her father was Jules Stein, founder of the media giant MCA in the 1920s. The Doheny's, the Garlands, the Warners, the Selznick's round out the cast of characters in West of Eden. Stein's works, few but influential, tackle similar themes: the cult of celebrity, the loneliness of fame, the tensions between West Coast and East Coast ideas of success. Joining me now to talk about Jean Stein and West of Eden is Maria Russo of the New York Times. She reviewed West of Eden for the Sunday Book Review. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, so we should say first that we asked Jean Stein to come on, and she's not giving any interviews for this book. But let's start with her most famous work. It's an oral history of Edie Sedgwick, who was Andy Warhol's muse, right?
Right. It's called Edie, American Girl. It was published in 1982. And that book was a huge bestseller, a big hit, and a really influential book for a lot of people. I remember reading it in college and just being electrified, first of all, by the form of it. Oral history is just so much fun. It's just people talking, and they're saying revealing and naughty and crazy things, and it kind of shifts around from voice to voice, so it's almost never gets boring.
Yeah.
So on the one end, the oral history form, I think, made it really exciting, and then the other hand, the story of this poor woman, Edie Sedgwick, it's just this one of those stories that just sticks in your mind, this American tragedy, really. You know, it's kind of in the tradition of the death of a beautiful woman.
Right,
you know,
right. A Californian who went east and found fame with Andy Warhol.
Yeah, you know, her family was an old New England family, but her parents, after they graduated from Harvard and Radcliffe, decided to come to Santa Barbara and live on ranches and try for a different kind of life. And it was a little bit kind of isolated and turned out to be sort of nutty. I mean, they were an old New England family, but there was like a lot of repression and it, you know, the story wasn't going so well, you know.
Yeah.
And then Edie herself came back east and became one of Andy Warhol's muses during that factory scene in the 1960s in New York City. So she becomes this kind of glamorous counterculture figure. But there again, you have, you know, this tragic story of a beautiful woman who's basically destroyed by the culture. He got sick of her eventually and kind of cast her out. And so she came back to Santa Barbara. At that point, she had a drug problem and had been, you know, in and out of mental institutions. And eventually she just died of an overdose at age 28, I think. So this story just kind of had something for everyone, and it was a bestseller. You know, so I think West of Eden, in a weird way, it's you know, many years later, but it kind of picks up from where that book left off.
Right. So she's talking about similar themes of fame, probably fame corrupting wealthy families and the dark secrets hidden behind big, massive closed doors.
Exactly.
So tell us about that. She focuses on these five families.
Yeah, well, so, and, you know, I think it's, you know, if someone picked up this book without having read Edie, they might be like, what do these five families have in common? They're all so different. I mean, so obviously they're all of these L.A. families, but they're really different. You have the Doheny's. You have, you know, which is basically an oil fortune. You have, you know, these Hollywood families, the Selznicks. But I think what you have to what you see in this book and you have to realize is the 20th century in LA, there was just so much up for grabs. There was so much money. And so in various places, you know, oil, movies, there's, you know, the Garland story, which is probably the least known in this book, a very tragic, another tragic, beautiful young woman who dies named Jane Garland. Actually, I'm not sure she dies. I'll take that back. But who has a serious illness. She's schizophrenic. And we don't even learn what happens to her, just that it doesn't go well for her. So you have this family that made its fortune in real estate. You have, by the end of Jennifer Jones's life, who was married to David Selznick, the producer, of course, her third husband was Norton Simon, you know, who made his fortune, I think, basically in tomatoes, you know, the Hunts.
Yeah.
So you had this real picture of all the money that was there for the taking in L.A. in the 20th century and the various ways these families could build very quickly compared to the East Coast, these fortunes. And of course, what goes along with that is, you know, not really very good for the children, especially.
So she was one of those children. She grew up in one of these families. Tell us about her.
So Jean Stein is really an interesting person. So she grew up, the house that she grew up in Beverly Hills is called Misty Mountain. It's one of the great mansions, you know, in L.A. And she talks about her childhood there as being kind of like make-believe. You know, there was this incredible pavilion by the pool where they could just sort of, you know, you didn't even have to pretend you were in a castle. It felt like you were in a castle. And she, you know, she grew up in this world of privilege and money, but there was a lot of, you know, what we would call now dysfunction. You know, her mother was drunk pretty much all of the time, it seems like, from the book. Her father was like a lot of these men who built their fortune at that time and possibly ever, was kind of a bully and domineering and had very, you know, strict ideas about what was okay and not okay for his two daughters, you know, Jean and her sister. So so she rebelled, and some of her rebellion was coming east and becoming more of an intellectual. Mm-hmm. She became, you know, the editor of Grand Street, a literary magazine. I think she might have put the money into starting it. Her daughter is Katrina Vandenhoevel, who's the editor of The Nation now. So yeah. She tried to become someone, you know, quite different from her Hollywood royalty family.
So the book is called West of Eden, An American Place. Does she have a dyspeptic, negative view of California, of Los Angeles, and kind of a rotten fruit perspective?
You know, I don't really think so. I think the book makes it look like, you know, all of these crazy characters who are really a lot of fun. You know, I mean, yes, there's a lot of murder and, you know, extortion. And, you know, she has a whole section on the Red Scare. And, you know, you can't believe, you know, the behavior of certain people. But
of Jack Warner in particular, right?
Jack Warner, you know, Ronald Reagan, you know, who was very, very willing to settle, you know, personal grudges by naming names to, you know, branding, you know, right, SAG members as communists while he was, you know, the president of SAG. So there's that stuff. But there's also this, I think there's this fascination in the book for just this incredible, beautiful place that's constantly reinventing itself. And the houses, I mean, each of the chapters, she starts the five sections with a house, an address, a description of a place, like, you know, her own family, it's Misty Mountain, you know, and there's a lot of talk about these incredible houses and what it was like to live in them, like the Doheny Mansion, for example, which was built in this very, you know, derivative East Coast style, but it had all of these things that are just magical, like the daughter had a dollhouse built, a playhouse that was three-quarter size of a normal house. And it was a full house, every piece of furniture, every appliance, but built child scale, you know.
Wow.
And so you have lots of people talking about coming over to play there, having memories of coming over to play there as a child. And it's just, you know, where but LA could anyone ever find that?
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Maria Russo of the New York Times. We're talking about the new book, West of Eden. It's an oral history by Jean Stein. And I wonder if you could talk about the women in your book, Ann Warner and Jennifer Jones. You write in your review that Jennifer Jones, who was an actress married to David O. Selznick, that she provides a masterclass in feminine manipulation.
Yeah, I loved the section on Jennifer Jones. I mean, she's an actress who was, you know, quite famous during her own lifetime, but now I think not. People probably don't remember her as much. I mean, I guess she won an Oscar for Song of Bernadette, and at the time was you know, very famous, but not considered one of the greats. And you see how she was able to use, you know, her marriages to these two powerful men, you know, first David Selznick and then Norton Simon, to create this just completely outlandish life for herself. Like, she would spend months at a time in Switzerland with one of her therapists, who she was also sleeping with. You know, she would spend months at a time in India while she had children. You know, they had these parties that she would, you know, change her clothes five times over the course of, I mean, I'm exaggerating, but so you have this person who, you know, started out life fairly modestly in Oklahoma. You know, her parents ran like a traveling circus or something, and she just becomes, you know, this ultimate Hollywood glamour symbol. But, you know, then you look closely at the behavior and it's just absolutely, you know, cracked. You know,
yeah.
Most of the time she's, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of, you know, sense. And, you know, she had this very famous suicide attempt where she walked into the ocean, you know, and of course was promptly rescued.
Unlike Virginia Woolf. Was she trying
right.
to imitate Virginia Woolf, maybe?
Yeah,
I don't
she
know.
Forgot the rocks
yeah.
in her pocket.
So when you put this book down, do you see a through line? Do you see the old Hollywood that is described in this book, West of Eden, in any way replicated in modern day Hollywood, modern day Los Angeles?
You know, not that strongly. I think what's interesting about this book is you really see kind of what looks to me, and I could be wrong, like the last gasp of this completely white and male-dominated Hollywood. I mean, yes, it's still white and male-dominated, but there are voices more and more speaking out against that, you know, and there are different kinds of people, you know, making their fortunes and influencing things somewhat now, and that just didn't happen then. I mean, the power that Jack Warner had was absolute and, you know, much more extreme than anything any studio head has now. So I think you're seeing a different model of Hollywood, and for LA too. I mean, I think it's always going to be the same geographic place, the same beauty, the same variety. You have the mountains, you have the ocean, you have the orange groves, and you have the oil, you know. But the energy of the city is so different now. You know, there's so much more excitement coming from different quarters of life besides just Hollywood. So it kind of, in some ways, is a picture of a Los Angeles that is passing into history. But it's, you know, you have to be aware of, you know, these are the roots of current Los Angeles, and it's good to know.
Maria Russo, she's children's book editor for the New York Times, took a break from the children's stuff to review Jean Stein's West of Eden for the New York Times. Maria, thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, Los Angeles had the hottest February on record. So what happened to all that rain we were supposed to get? A meteorologist from NOAA will be here to explain next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Remember El Nino? We came into this year with big predictions for rain, but now February is over, and here in L.A. at least, it was one of the hottest, if not the hottest, on record. So what gives? Alex Tardy is a meteorologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in San Diego. Hi there.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. So where did it go? Where is El Nino for us?
That's the big question, and the simple way to look at it is that El Nino, which is the tropical ocean conditions that we look at down near the equator, so south of Hawaii, it itself has been the strongest on record, and that's just measuring the warm ocean temperatures. But for you and me and everyone else, you know, we measure it by rain and what the weather is in the backyard and that type of thing. And not only was February a disappointment, we broke records, warmest ever in L.A. and San Diego, and top 10 driest. And so far this year, the area in California that has had the least amount of rain compared to what they normally should have is the L.A. Basin. So the big question is what happened in February, complete opposite of 1998. The short answer is the storms are out there, and there's been massive swell proving it in Hawaii, Big Sur. But those storms haven't been reaching us, at least yet.
They've been reaching Northern California instead.
They did in January and in December, but even the month of February, as much as they gained on the rain and the snow and the impact on the drought improving it, it shut off for Northern California too, at least during February. So the whole state has been impacted by this very warm, kind of a large rock in the river blocking our weather pattern and steering all the storms. And there's been strong storms over the Pacific. They've just been going to our north.
So is this the famous ridiculously resilient ridge we've heard about?
Yeah. You know, loosely a scientific term, I guess. And the explanation kind of goes towards a few things. We think it's related to El Nino itself, the tropical ocean conditions not being as far east, not going all the way up to South America along the equator, so being more concentrated further out in the ocean, affecting more the central and western Pacific, where we've seen that persistent storm track and much stronger than normal storm track. And also the very warm ocean temperatures themselves, even outside of El Nino, the eastern Pacific has been running incredibly warm over the past 2 years. That's also been helping our temperatures and terms of keeping them elevated, especially at nighttime. There's other things we're looking at, like lack of snow cover in the Arctic region. But there's been extreme weather across a lot of part of the United States, including the Northeast, where they've had trouble even keeping any snow on the ground. And the northern plains, where it's normally very cold, is another face of El Nino. That area has been running much above normal, even more than we have. So the ridge of high pressure is the immediate cause, you know, of what's been going on, but we don't know exactly sure why it's been so persistent, especially smack in the middle of the winter.
Yeah. So we got all these predictions, and I remember all the headlines. They were back in the fall or in December predicting this deluge. Everyone should prepare their backyards and buy a bunch of umbrellas and just get battened down the hatches, as it were. Why was everyone so wrong? And are you guys embarrassed?
First off, no, we're definitely not embarrassed. Let's take a step back and look at the prediction. So the prediction was that we would be above normal in terms of rainfall. You know, in San Diego, it's 10 inches. In L.A., it's a little bit more, closer to 15. So above normal in rainfall basically means you'll exceed that annual value. You know, for you and me, that means, okay, we'll have more rainy days and that type of thing. It doesn't necessarily imply that we'll have flooding or the biggest storm ever or maybe the wettest winter ever, that type of thing. Now, that said, when we think of El Nino, especially strong El Ninos like the one we're dealing with right now, even still actively in the Pacific, 1998, 83, 58, those years kind of come up because those are comparable strong El Ninos. And in those years, we were very wet. In fact, we broke some records in February 98. We broke some records in 82, 83. That's the wettest year on record for the whole state of California as a whole. And tremendous snowpack, too, that year, by the way. So the expectations were above normal rainfall, and we're well short of that. We're 30 to 50% in the worst areas of the L.A. Basin. We're closer to 80% of normal in San Diego, so San Diego's lucked out a little bit more. But then to address what you asked about, you know, being embarrassed about it, we're trying to forecast something months in advance when in reality a weather forecast anywhere in the United States or the world for that matter, imagine forecasting Hurricane Sandy or forecasting a series of snowstorms across the Northeast or even across Seattle. It's difficult to do that more than 7 to 10 days out. You just have very little skill beyond 10 days. But what we've been trying to do is, you know, forecast for an entire winter several months in advance. Gosh, we started, what, in September, August? So it's a long ways out, and so there's a lot of room for error in those type of forecasts. Now, that said, you know, the month of March potentially is going to turn out to be a different story.
You're saying potentially. You're hedging your bet. So we could have some rain in March, is what you're saying?
The expectations are starting with our first storm. Now that we're into March, it's March 1st, and we're a little bit closer to that magical 1 to 2 week period where beyond 2 weeks, beyond 10 days, it's very difficult to forecast with any accuracy. You could be right and be off by a day or two. You could be completely off. It could be sunny when you think it's going to rain 12 days from now. But now that we're getting within that window, yes, all points or tools that we use to indicate whether there's going to be rain or not are indicating significant storms coming our way. The first one would be Sunday and Monday of this weekend, and that one looks quite powerful. Not going to be historical, because keep in mind, you know, with El Nino, we don't look at 100-year, 200-year type rain events. We just look at good, healthy storms that when you add them all up, that brings us to above normal. At least that's what was expected. And then we have other storms that are in the Pacific right now that we can see this far out between the 11th and 13th of March, so about 10 or so days from now. And those look even good, if not better. And the exciting thing about it is not just that it's going to rain, is that it's also going to move into our mountains, the Sierra Nevada. It's going to be a statewide type rain and snow event or multiple events. And so that's good. That's very okay. Beneficial, not just for us down here for fire weather conditions, because we know most of our water is taken from the mountain region, right. And we really need it there.
Okay, we're going to hold you to it. Sunday, yeah. Monday, the 11th through the 13th. Alex Tardy, meteorologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joey Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hello.
El Nino has made dates with us before, Madeline.
And canceled at the last minute.
And ghosted. No calls, no text. Would have been nice to know something.
Bad boyfriend, El Nino.
El Nino is like the worst boyfriend ever. I can't wait for La Nina. But R.A. Allman on Facebook says that, you know what? It's been the best surf we've had for the last 20 years. I'm seeing El Nino all over the place. So I guess we found out where El Nino is. Hanging out with R.A. Allman and all of his surfer buddies.
Okay, yeah. I mean, Alex was talking about Hawaii having a big effect or being affected by El Nino.
So right, right. So maybe it's time. It's our turn. El Nino.
Or we can just go to Hawaii.
All right.
Jolie Myers, thank you very much. Warren Olney and To the Point is up next at 1 o'clock, so keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great, warm, sunny afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.